I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And we're Building Bridges.
We are now joined by the Professor of Community Justice and Social Economic Development in the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay Cooney College, affiliate scholar as well of the Center for the Study of Cooperatives at the University City of Saskatchewan, and affiliate scholar with the Economics Department Center on Race and Wealth at Howard University, Jessica Gordon-Nemphart, while she is rising up with us.
Professor Gordon is a political economist specializing in community economics, black political economy, and popular economic literacy, and whose research and writings explore cooperative economic development and worker ownership, community economic development, wealth inequality, and community-based asset building. Her book on black cooperatives, Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice, is a foundational work on the subject.
Professor, I want you to take us into the politics of cooperative development and their functioning, and why that has captivated your attention and stimulated your ongoing research as a way of talking about workers rising up.
Yes, thanks so much for having me, Mimi and Ken. And I also do want to start out by acknowledging the original stewards of the land, the Lenape here in New York City area, and also to acknowledge my ancestors, all those who were enslaved, continue to labor without just compensation, and our movement ancestors. So I became an economist, I'm a political economist, because I was raised by social activists who taught me that I needed to use knowledge to make the world better. And, you know, we were, I was on picket lines combating racial and gender injustice and all kinds of stuff. And as I grew up, I realized that economic inequality was one of the biggest barriers to achieving justice, right? And so I slowly started focusing on how do we use and understand economics as a tool to really create abundance and prosperity, rather than to see it as this limiting, oppressive tool that it is, right? And so within that, you know, I became a PhD in economics, and on my own, really, I started studying solidarity economics and cooperative economics and community-based economic development. I now come to understand and articulate labor as really the expenditure of human energy in solidarity with others so that we can produce and reproduce for the common good. And yet, right, our capitalist system gets in the way of that, right? We're all doing caring, reproductive work that's very invisible in addition to our visible paid work, but we're so exploited by the capitalist system, right, which exploits workers, it exploits the land, it exploits human beings, it exploits human mother nature. And so I've started focusing on the ways that we can address that, right? What are the solutions? Economists are often called, you know, the depressing discipline or whatever, because we're always
dismal
focused
science
on what's wrong and what's bad. And
science.
You know, yeah. I wanted to focus on what was working, what's good, and I learned that cooperatives, solidarity, economic activity, mutual aid, and especially worker cooperatives are what's working, right? They're combating the dehumanization, the privatization, the enclosure, the oppression. And so I'm looking for ways that we can use economics as a liberatory structure, and so worker co-ops help us do that.
Well, how do you think co-ops can address economic exploitation? And is that just an idea or is it practice you want to talk about?
And maybe if you can actually realize that through a historic reference as well.
Yes, I'd be happy to. So the more I started studying cooperative economics, right, I learned that it helps to address market failure, underdevelopment, and economic isolation and marginality so that co-ops, because they are values-based enterprises owned and run by a group of people in a democratic manner, their purpose is not profit maximization, but to address problems provide affordable, accessible goods and services that are controlled by community members, that redistribute the so-called profits, or co-ops really call them surplus, back to the members and then to the community, right? So these are economic structures that, instead of being based on exploiting, you know, how can you pay the least amount to labor so that the owners can get the most? How do you, you know, instead of exploiting the land and the natural resources, right? These are structures that allow us to use that positive human relationships and human labor to then create economic structures that allow us to create, right, to produce the goods and services that we need to live and to live good lives, and then to redistribute so that everybody has what they need and everybody can gain. I like to start with the 1880s because, to me, it's still a very fascinating period. It was the fall of Reconstruction, right? So after emancipation and Reconstruction, it was the reassertion of white supremacist terrorism and violence and reaction, right, to the liberalism, so-called liberalism of the Reconstruction period, when we were trying to figure out how to end slavery and integrate people of color into the system. So now we're in the 1880s, and the conservatives are back in power, the white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan are in power, they're terrorizing, stopping people from voting, terrorizing people who are doing any economic activity, and yet it's one of our most progressive economic periods because early organized labor is connected with the populist movement, so the belief in the small grassroots ownership and people and grassroots agriculture and worker control of factories and things like that. They're also connected to the co-op movement. They believe in integration, so that they believe that you can't fight for workers' rights if you're not also fighting for black workers' rights and women's rights. And so all the things that we think of as in the progressive movement that we kind of have fought for separately are all actually being fought together in those organizations in the 1880s, exemplified by one of the largest ones, the Knights of Labor. And there's a fabulous study of the Working Men's Reform Party that the Knights of Labor started in 1885 in Richmond, Virginia. They were able to win control of the city council, so they had a political platform, right? They ran candidates and won the city council. They had an economic platform, which was unionization. They believed in unionized local workforces that included women and men, black and white, and that the unionized labor also should have the right and should be able to create worker cooperatives in construction and other ways to control their own work. And they won the city council in part because they wanted to be able to control who built the new city hall that had been destroyed during the Civil War. And they were able to win control, and then instead of hiring convict labor, which the other administration had wanted to do, they hired integrated unionized local workforces and worker co-ops that were connected to the Knights of Labor. Fascinating combination of issues. There was also a black version of it, even though Knights of Labor were integrated. Many of the black farmers and farm workers around the South realized they needed their own organization, and so they started the Colored Farmers National Alliance and Cooperative Union, 1886 to around 1891. And that one was black farmers and black farm workers. So again, this interesting combination, people who had land and people who had to sell their own labor. But they realized again that it was all the same fight for control over labor, control over their economy, self-determination and prosperity. And they, throughout the South, had chapters that created all different kinds of cooperatives and what they called lending centers, and they weren't credit unions yet because the U.S. didn't have laws yet for credit unions, but these were lending exchanges so that they could afford to buy equipment, buy land. They often shared equipment, things like that, again, to counteract the violence and the exploitation.
Now we're going back to the 1880s here, and far more advanced politically than our worker-based organizations today. But what do you see within the cooperative movement at that juncture that brought about a consideration during one of the most repressive times, and yet the cooperatives were inclusive and equalizers in many ways? Or am I wrong? How do they structurally act as democratizing vehicles to deal with the kind of terrifying white supremacy? How does it deal with women, which are similarly situated as to the bias?
So it was hard, right? So I'm not saying that it was easy what they were doing, but the point was that there was this commitment, both political, ideological, spiritual commitment to real economic justice and economic equality. There was this recognition that you couldn't achieve that without all these different coalitions, right? So the unions, the co-op people, the race justice people, the gender justice, right? They all realized they had to be in this together. Because otherwise, if they were siphoned off, they would be fighting each other for crumbs, right? And they wouldn't be addressing the systemic issues. So there was really that consciousness. So a lot of it was just in the speeches that people made, in the newsletter writings that were done. But as I said, this thing that also was helpful was the actual structure of a co-op business. It requires that you have multiple people. It requires that those multiple people to have a say, get to vote on things, and that they don't vote versus how much money they put in or even versus how much time they put into the business. They vote because they're a member. It's one member, one vote. And so there was those kinds of structural things in addition to, right, this commitment that recognizing that this was about a movement, right, that they had to change things, they had to be in solidarity with each other because otherwise it wouldn't work. So those efforts get a little bit defeated by the 1890s and the early 1900s, but then they start up again by the 20s and the 30s. And by the Great Depression, you actually have another strong movement, similar, not quite as well correlated between the different movements, but you have another strong movement for co-op development. This time even FDR's administration is helping with a little bit of money. But you have a strong, again, strong group, especially my studies of the black co-op movement, the 1930s and 40s are another strong movement. You have an organization like the Young Negroes Cooperative League, which is deliberately talking about this need to connect with women, to connect with labor, to connect with local community, to have the co-ops address local community problems in this democratic economic justice way. So that it's very relevant. So you have an Ella Jo Baker, who's one of the co-founders of the Young Negroes Cooperative League. This is 1930, so way before the 1950s and 60s, Ella Jo Baker that most people know. But here she is in the middle of, right, economic justice movement. And she's going around talking about, in fact, the first major speech she makes at their first conference is how important it is that women be included and that women be seen as leaders in the co-op movement. So that's her first speech in a public setting. 600 people attend that Young Negroes Cooperative League first conference in Pittsburgh, right? So you've got that. And then at the same time, you've got A. Philip Randolph, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and the Ladies Auxiliary to the Porters, the first official black union. They're also telling their members about co-ops and that the only way to really keep union wages recirculating in the black community and controlled by blacks is to do co-op development and to have urban co-op development surrounding their union members. And so there's, again, this is the 30s and 40s, you've got these leaders articulating how important it is that we have to have this economic democracy and self-determination on the economic sphere if we really want to have true liberation and truly achieve civil rights and social justice.
Labor Day, which was indeed founded by, to a large extent, the Knights of Labor back in 1882.
Right.
How is that an inspiration to today, and what kind of examples of worker co-ops, and what do you see as the future worker co-ops for today and tomorrow and the next day?
Well, I think it's a great honor to the Knights of Labor that here we are in the 2020s, and I'm actually beginning to talk about this as being the fourth most prolific period of co-op development, especially in the black community, and this time it's pretty much led by food co-ops and worker co-ops. And so we, again, because of, the strong need for mutual aid and alternatives in our society. We're seeing again that people are realizing coming together to create cooperatives, worker co-ops, that they see mutual aid as not being enough, right? We really need to run and control our own enterprises, our own businesses. And so we've got a lot of interesting co-op development. The third most prolific period was the 60s and 70s, and so we had the Black Panthers doing co-op stuff. We had several different sewing co-ops come out of that period also, especially women-run sewing co-ops. We've got nursing co-ops, and then one of my favorite examples is Cooperative Home Care Associates, which actually starts in the 1980s. But is still with us today and is the largest worker co-op in the U.S. It's a worker-owned home health care association, employs mostly low-skilled, low-income Latina and African-American women, but figured out how to provide full-time, benefited, unionized work for home health care providers. In fact, they have a nonprofit training subsidiary that makes sure they provide state-of-the-art training and that they can train women to move up into the company. So you can start very unskilled home care work. You can be trained to be a nurse. You can be trained to be in the management of the company. And it's all owned by the workers themselves. It actually leads the industry in above-average wages, benefits, career ladder opportunities, and also helps with asset building of their members, right, between their, they have a savings program and a retirement program. And they're, as I said, they're our largest worker cooperative. One other one that's unionized and that started with a union drive and the demand for the workers to actually take over the company is New Era Windows in Chicago.
Right.
Which is about 10 years old now. They also have been luckily been able to connect worker ownership and worker co-ops with being union members. And so there's that connection. And then I've also looked at what's happening with some young people, especially young blacks, starting their own co-ops in order to help address the community need, but also to provide themselves with income that they control and meaningful work in ways that give back to their communities. So Toxic Soil Busters, in the 1990s, it was Food from the Hood in L.A., Toxic Soil Busters in Worcester. And now I'm studying other countries that
tell our listeners again that we're speaking with Professor Jessica Gordon-Nemthard, one of the most prolific researchers and the most knowledgeable on the issue of the American, and we're about to get into beyond that, a cooperative movement. But before we hit some of the international issues, one of the things I do want to understand in your opinion is you've mentioned all these different kinds of black youth-owned cooperatives, home care associates, the former window plant, which was where workers were about to be driven out of business when they sought to cooperatize it. Actually, the Spectrum workers in New York, who are still officially on strike and had looked to and are still looking to put together a kind of worker cooperative model for getting their jobs back and for cabling the city and using their skills. Yep. But politically,
and there's the drivers, right? There's a taxi drivers co-op that just started in New York.
But I'm also wondering whether or not you see these separate entities which have had enormous importance in the communities that they have sprung forward in, but do you see them also as a kind of stepping stone to a transformative process of political and economic social structuring that
yes.
can dismantle effectively and cause to be dismantled the capitalist system, which is such
Absolutely.
A cruel, profit-driven, heartless system?
Right. Yes, absolutely. And these are the reasons why. Once we start to practice this kind of economic democracy, we realize how viable it is to organize our economy in a different way, right? We've been told all the time that the only way you can do economics is to be profit-driven, right, and to exploit everybody else. That's the only way we can make it. You know, neoclassical economic theory actually has a theory about how owners can be greedy, but it still helps everybody in the end, right, which we know it doesn't. But operating and working in your own co-op, having especially worker co-ops, people can see, one, that you can run a business and be democratic, right? You can actually come to consensus with a group of workers without too much trouble, especially if everybody's trained well in how to run a good meeting and how to come to consensus, right? So you can have actually real democracy at the workplace, real democracy among the workers to make decisions about, you know, everything from healthcare to how to make the product. Right. So we know when people start to own their own worker co-ops that then they see how possible it is. They also start getting used to the democracy and the transparency, right, because we don't really live in a real democracy. We barely live in a democracy. But when you're in a worker co-op, that's real democracy at work. We're experiencing it. We're learning how to do it. And then we start to expect it in other aspects of our lives. So we start to practice it at home. We practice it in our other civic organizations. We try to look for it or advocate for it other places, so there's spillover effect. We also learn what's called social capital, right? Leadership, how to work together, how to network with people, how to make joint decisions, how to put a proposal together to get consensus, right? We learn all those skills, and so of course we're human beings, we're going to start using them in other places. Not only that, we're making a living. Most of the time, worker co-ops are able to pay their members decent wages, right, decent salaries, and they have profit sharing. So not only do they get decent salaries and benefits, but they also can divvy up some of the surplus, the profits at the end, and that's an addition to what they make. So there's income coming in, regular income, stabilizing you, stabilizing your family and your neighborhood, and then you're getting wealth. You're developed, right? You're gaining assets. Owning a successful business is actually an asset, right? It's a physical and a financial asset. So you're increasing your income, you're increasing your assets, you're increasing your skills. All those things have spillover effects. You see that you can do it in other places. You start to want to put your money in a credit union, which is a co-op, right? You think about co-op housing. That's a better, right? So it gets you to think about how we could create these co-op, what we call co-op commonwealths and co-op ecosystems for all the different businesses that we have to be involved in are co-ops. We start to want to buy our supplies from another co-op, and so we help to develop other co-ops to grow the system. And we can see, right, when people say another world is possible, being in a worker co-op shows you that another world is possible, and you're a part of it. And so I think it makes a huge difference in how people see the world, how people see what's possible, and what other things people want to demand, and we stop accepting, right, the status quo.
I want you to take us out with, you were beginning to get into, which I thought was extremely interesting and important. You were talking about co-ops, indeed other areas of the world, but you actually had mentioned to me the issue of co-ops in Puerto Rico, in Ethiopia, and that were taking place in the prison system amongst people, right, who are incarcerated. And I think, again, that's another dimension that is most important in response to, certainly for those of us who want to eliminate the carceral state in this country. Yeah. So take us out with those kind of examples and what you've begun to research and learn about.
As I learned that co-ops, especially worker co-ops, were a great strategy for oppressed people, right, especially African Americans, I started to think about, well, what other places is there so much marginality that a co-op might make a difference? And so I started studying incarcerated worker co-ops. I heard from a couple people that other countries had them. Italy is especially one, Sweden, Brazil, Uruguay, Ethiopia, Puerto Rico. And so I started inquiring and starting to learn about, I'm doing a study right now to find out what research there is out there. And what I'm finding is that some countries, Iran also is another one, and Canada, are having great success with allowing their incarcerated workers, incarcerated people, caged people, to start and own and run their own cooperatives. And the ones I'm really excited about are Ethiopia and Puerto Rico, because those, they literally don't have an intermediary. Some of the other ones, they own the co-op with other people, with outsiders and stuff. But in Ethiopia and Puerto Rico, the co-ops are literally owned and run by the worker, incarcerated workers themselves. And so what happens in Ethiopia, it's a combination of the state and the main prison in one of the states. This is the Menkele prison, started a program where they wanted to figure out how to empower women and other incarcerated members so that when they got out, they could reduce recidivism and they could be positioned to really enter society again. And so they helped them to organize cooperatives. They have a financial, a microfinance program right on the in the prison, so they've got access to capital. They train some of the corrections officers in how to be co-op developers to help teach the inmates how to start and run their own co-ops, and then they give them the micro loans, the vocational training, et cetera, to start and run their co-ops. If they actually get out on parole or get out, they can continue to work in their co-op so they don't lose their livelihood. They just don't live in the prison anymore. And these have allowed them to, you know, gain a better stronghold, right, economically, to provide for their family, to gain skills, and, as we said, to be owners of a business, regardless of whether they're behind bars or not.
So fascinating. I really want to thank you for taking us through some of the history of workers rising up and in this particular formation and structure to assume power in the society as a whole. We've been speaking with Jessica Gordon-Nemphard. For what?
Absolutely.
For power to the workers. And you've been listening to Building Bridges.
With Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
And we continue to say, educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for a better world as possible if we work real hard to make it so. Thanks for listening.